Dr. Campbell, is it you?
Yes, it is.
Oh, excellent. Okay, great. I'm so glad that you were able to join me today. This is Karen Thomas from NaturallyHealingAutism.com, and we are being recorded. So today, our very, very special guest is Dr. Fran Kendall. And Dr. Kendall, I'm going to go ahead and read a little bit off of your bio so our listeners are a bit familiar with your background and what you do. Dr. Kendall is a super sub specialist, Harvard trained physician with a 25 plus year career pioneering and specializing in metabolic, mitochondrial, and inherited disorders. Many of her patients also have autism, Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, and hypermobility. To Dr. Kendall's knowledge, she has the only independent genetic practice focused on these disorders in the world. Her practice, VMP, stands for Virtual Medical Practice, and was born of the need to enable people worldwide access to complex care when no such care exists locally. About 80% of the practice is seeing patients in their offices at the VMP Genetics Clinic, while 20% are remote, reaching from Russia to South Africa to China. Dr. Kendall is a board-certified clinical biochemical geneticist that founded the very first clinical mitochondrial disease clinic in the U.S., sits on the medical advisory board of the National Foundation, mitoaction.org, and is one of the specialists chosen by the United Mitochondrial Disease Foundation to be their regional medical representative. Wow, and you've written chapters on these disorders for medical texts and been on Fox News, et cetera. There's a lot here. And Dr. Kendall, again, thank you so much for giving some of your, I know, very precious time to be here today. I would love to just let you kind of just, you know, feel free to you know, explain a little bit, especially to our listeners, because some of them don't even know what mitochondria is. So starting from almost scratch, like, okay, what is it, how it affects especially children on the autism spectrum, and then also things that that you've been successful finding that you can do for it.
Okay. First, thanks so much for the opportunity to speak to you today, and it is my great pleasure to do so. So as Karen indicated, I am a biochemical geneticist, and I am a mitochondrial disease expert. So the mitochondria, we'll start with an explanation of them in general and then segue into mitochondrial disease specifically. So for those of you who recall your biology, the mitochondria are the batteries or the powerhouses of our body cells. Now, remember that our cells are the smallest functioning unit of our body. Cells together, many cells together make up tissues and sheets of tissues, just like sheets of tissues in a Kleenex box, make up our organs and, of course, our entire body. So, again, cells are the smallest functioning unit of our body, and the powerhouses of those cells are known as mitochondria. So they are, they appear in appearance, they look like kidney beans, and they have an outer membrane and an inner membrane. And embedded within the inner membrane are biochemical pathways that generate energy. So our body takes in food, as we all know, and we digest it and break it down in our digestive system. And then within our body cells, the food is chopped into little small chemical packets, which then, along with oxygen and phosphate, get shunted into our mitochondria to get converted into something known as ATP. So ATP is adenosine triphosphate, but ATP is, again, it's like a unit, it's a unit of energy, and you can, a good analogy is a battery. So that ATP is then shunted out of the mitochondria around the cell to complete any of its functions. So mitochondrial disease are diseases, and it's an umbrella heading because there's many subtypes under that umbrella heading. They are diseases that affect the body's ability to adequately produce that energy. So if the body does not adequately produce energy, the body systems that are most affected are the brain and the central nervous system, the heart, the muscle, kidneys, and liver. And so in the pediatric population, most affected individuals will have a host of neurological problems, primarily things like developmental delays, muscle weakness, and low tone. And included in those developmental issues can certainly be autism and the autism spectrum problems. These kids can certainly have additional issues to include GI problems ranging from constipation to severe GI dysmotility, to things with autonomic dysfunction where they have problems regulating their body temperature and heart rate and blood pressure, and again, a number of other issues. So, and adults will often present with things like exercise intolerance and weakness. They can certainly have some of the other problems as well, but a lot of the neurological complications and mitochondrial disease are really linked and found specifically in children. So, as I mentioned, it's a very broad spectrum group of problems that affect the mitochondria's ability to produce energy. Now, an important thing to keep in mind as far as the mitochondria and their functionality is that they are regulated by 1,500 different genes. Now, if anybody in the audience knows much about genes and genetics, what they know is that most often you have one gene that, if it's altered, produces a disease like cystic fibrosis or sickle cell anemia. So the fact that there are 1,500 different genes that regulate mitochondrial functioning certainly indicates that it's a very complicated group of diseases. So, having said that, when children or adults present with a number of the clinical symptoms that can be seen with mitochondrial disease, then we have to undergo a complex evaluation to determine whether or not, indeed, they have that disorder or not. Now, specifically in regards to the autism population, I just want to digress for a few minutes to talk about some of the data that's associated with the link between mitochondrial disease and autism, and some of the clinical features that the ASD kids will often have in addition to their autism features that may be a clue and a cue that they have mitochondrial disease and that it is warranted for them to be investigated. So, the kids, it would be the data, some of the first studies that showed some links with autism were reported back in 2005 and 2007 by a group in Portugal. And that group showed that about, in their study, between 4% and 7% of the ASD population that they evaluated were determined to have mitochondrial disease as the ultimate cause for their problems. And we certainly have seen other case reports as well that show that there's a link. And then one of the more recent studies was in the Journal of the American Medical Association in November 2010, where a group out in California, I believe it was UC Davis, where they looked at a group of of autism patients and had them undergo a number of studies looking for association and signs of mitochondrial dysfunction. And they found that about 60% of the kids had some signs that their mitochondria might not be working as well as they should. What they did not determine in that study was how many of those children ultimately were determined to have a true gene mutation that indicated that they indeed their primary problem was a mitochondrial disease with autism and autism features as a secondary problem. So there's some of the initial studies, and one of my colleagues, Dr. Richard Fry, who works in both autism and mitochondrial disease in terms of research, Richard has shown in some of his data that when he's looked at certain autism populations, he's found that a gene mutation in about 25% of those kids, and that was a study he did a few years ago. So his data may be updated. I just haven't spoken to Richard about it recently. So clearly, there's been a number of studies that have shown that a certain percentage of children with autism do have mitochondrial disease as a primary cause for their problems. Now, we of course only know that after they're investigated. So how do we earmark those individuals that are more likely than not to be determined to have a mitochondrial disease, as opposed to something else as a cause for their problem? So, again, a couple of studies that have shown some of the clinical features that folks have seen most consistently, and I as well see this in my patient population, that are red flags for mitochondrial disease in the ASD population are other neurological findings such as hypotonia or low muscle tone. Certainly seizures are another red flag. These kids will often have GI problems, and that can be very variable. That can range from some inflammatory bowel disease type of features to constipation and sometimes even more significant dysmotility of their gut, meaning that they end up with feeding tubes and things of that nature. These kids often deal with considerable fatigue. So they prefer to engage in quiet activities as opposed to running around. And then autonomic dysfunction is another finding that we see as a kind of a comorbid problem in the ASD population. And again, the autonomic nervous system is that part of the central nervous system that regulates heart rate, blood pressure, and temperature. And so a lot of these kids will overheat easily in the warm weather months. Sometimes they'll get very cold and colder in cold climates, colder than you would expect them to be. And sometimes they have heart rate and blood pressure issues. So, again, in kind of a summation of that digression, before I talk a little bit about the investigation and what we need to do to determine if somebody has mitochondrial disease, clearly there's been a number of studies over the last decade plus that have shown a link between autism and mitochondrial disease. And of course, those of us in the field have certainly noticed that trend. So long before the studies came out, as a mitochondrial disease expert for over 20 years, I certainly noticed that a number of children would have, that were diagnosed with mitochondrial disease would have autism or autistic-like features. And again, some of the problems that are seen more readily in that population are things like seizures, hypotonia, GI issues, fatigability, and autonomic dysfunction. So once we've earmarked an individual for the possibility of mitochondrial disease, what do we have to do to confirm that diagnosis? Well, unfortunately, it's complicated, and it's not a simple test. So unlike something like Fragile X, where you do the test and you look at the Fragile X gene, someone either has it or doesn't. But mitochondrial disease is a lot more complicated, and we often are required to look at multiple parameters and do multiple studies to make a diagnosis or to come close to a diagnosis of mitochondrial disease in a given patient. So we have a number of tiers of studies and parameters we look at. Of course, clinical features are one. Radiographic findings. Some patients with mitochondrial disease have very distinctive brain MRI changes. So if we find those, then of course that's suggestive of this disease group. Then we have what I refer to as biomarker and biochemical studies. So we do a number of blood and urine studies to look for markers that are out of whack, that are reflective of poor energy production in tissue, in various tissues. So certainly, if the liver is affected, you'll see elevated liver function tests. If muscle is affected, you'll often see elevated lactate levels. You'll see elevated CPK, which is a muscle enzyme. These patients can often have low carnitine levels. and sometimes low vitamin D levels. So we look at a bunch of blood and urine studies, again, looking for markers that are consistently seen and are abnormal over and over again in the mitochondrial population. So that's the first step, but that none of that testing is definitively diagnostic, but it does help us if it's positive. And about 50% of people, some of those studies will be positive. In the autism community, the most commonly abnormal studies are lactate, which is often elevated, and carnitine, which will be low. The next kind of tier of testing we have available to us, or tiers, are genetic testing, and then functional testing, which is unfortunately is invasive testing and is looking at that biochemical pathway inside the mitochondria that I first started talking about, that electron transport chain that generates ATP. So as far as the genetic testing goes, that's gotten much, much better over recent years. About 10 years ago, we could detect about 10%, maybe 15% of the gene mutations in mitochondrial disease patients. That's now about 50 to 60%. So it's much better, but it's not 100%. So there's a number of different panels of mitochondrial genes that we can look at. Some of us will when we're investigating somebody for mitochondrial disease or other neurodevelopmental problems, we will sometimes use these mitochondrial gene panels, and other times we will use more advanced genomics that look at far more genes, and some of that testing is known as whole exome sequencing. And what happens sometimes when we use the whole exome sequencing, the advantage of using that is sometimes we will identify other non-mitochondrial genes that perhaps are the cause for a given child's problems. And I just got an exome result back yesterday on a patient who came to me with autism and concerns about mitochondrial disease, and he turned out to have a neurodevelopmental gene mutation, a brain development gene mutation that is known to be associated with autism. So he did not have mitochondrial disease, but did have an identifiable gene cause for his problems. And then the last type of studies we have are, again, functional studies. The problem with functional studies are that they are invasive, which means, you know, it's difficult enough to get blood and urine studies from children, but certainly putting them through skin and muscle biopsies is challenging at best and requires often sedation, including general anesthesia, to collect those samples. So we don't do muscle biopsies as frequently as we did 10, 15 years ago in the evaluation of mitochondrial disease for a couple of reasons. Of course, one of them is the invasiveness of the procedure, but the other is because the biopsies are not as clear-cut as we had hoped. What I mean by that is, unlike a biopsy for a tumor where your doctor will say it's positive or it's negative, meaning you do have cancer or you don't, it's not always that clear-cut with the information we get from a muscle biopsy, making it even more doubly difficult to have a child undergo such a procedure. But if it's determined by the evaluating physician that it is warranted, what we do with that muscle tissue is several-fold. We certainly look at the muscle tissue under the microscope, and we look at the structure of the mitochondria. Are they an appropriate size? Are they formed normally? Are there extra mitochondria? All of those can be clues to problems with mitochondrial functioning. And then the other important thing we do with the muscle tissue is we measure that enzyme pathway that I've mentioned several times, that electron transport chain. So using special instruments known as a spectrophotometer and control samples, we will measure the different chemicals in that electron transport chain to see if they are at the levels that are typical for normal functionality. So if an individual has reduced activity in those enzymes compared to controls, then that could very much be reflective of a mitochondrial disease. So, you know, again, as you can see, hear and from my discussion, it's not an easy diagnosis. It's not like diabetes. You either have high blood sugar or you don't, and you either have diabetes or you don't. Mitochondrial disease is a little bit more challenging because we're required to consider multiple tiers of testing before we can come to our conclusion. And even after all of that, sometimes it's still not clear. We might have a child who has a lot of the clinical features, but when we do all of that testing, maybe we don't find a gene mutation, but we have an elevated lactate on multiple occasions and a low carnitine, and we do a biopsy and there's some changes on the muscle structure, but it's not absolute. And so in a case like that, somebody like me who's done this for long enough may say, given his clinical features or her clinical findings, in the light of this testing, we think this is what they have. So again, it's complicated, but certainly you need to have somebody who's familiar with the testing and understands the complexities of it if you're going to embark on this type of investigation. So the next questions that arise with talking about mitochondrial disease and autism or any other genetic disorder, and it's linked to autism, is really, why do we do it? And meaning, why do we do the investigation? What do we get out of it in general? And then specifically, what can we do for ASD patients who turn out to have mitochondrial disease? Well, there's a couple of high-level implications that I'll talk about first, and then I'll segue into talking specifically about what do we do with the information for the autism mito population. So the first thing in terms of genetic testing in general is in regards to things like recurrence risk and implications for other family members. So certainly if a child with autism is found to have a gene mutation in a neurodevelopmental gene that's only found in him or her, well, then the other siblings and the parents are not at risk for recurrence. But if a child is found to have a mitochondrial gene mutation, and most often in the pediatric population, mitochondrial gene mutations are inherited in an autosomal recessive fashion, which means both parents are carriers of the gene changes. And so, as such, their other children, even if not symptomatic, may also be carriers, but the couple themselves are at a 25% risk for having another child with similar problems. So they're kind of the high-level implications of a genetic diagnosis.
I'm also wondering about parents as a form of almost prevention or things to know ahead. Is it easy enough for a parent to go ahead and get this? Is it just blood work for this genetic testing that can tell if there's a mitochondrial, weakness or possibilities for things that parents could say, you know, you're looking at having children in the future, and you say, okay, both of us are carriers. So it gets into also that gray area now where I live in California, where they're mandating vaccinations, where somebody could use that genetic testing as a piece to say, hey, we're at risk, and we don't feel that it would be safe for a child to have that. I mean, is it something parents could use ahead of time?
Well, if your question is about the parents undergoing the genetic testing, mm-hmm. that doesn't really work for a couple of reasons. One is there are certainly sporadic or de novo gene mutations in children, meaning they're not really inherited, even though it's a change in their genetic blueprint.
Okay.
So that's the first thing. The second thing is because mitochondrial disease is an umbrella heading, and there's, you know, again, there's 1,500 genes that live under that umbrella. That's a lot of genes to evaluate. And the problem also is that, you know, when you're looking at a parent, for example, if you and you're doing it in a proactive way, meaning, okay, these parents don't have kids yet. They're just trying to see what the risks are. Because we find variants, what's referred to as variants of unknown significance all the time in our genetic blueprint and in the genetic blueprint of patients, it's possible that you would find gene changes in parents and have no idea whether they would actually lead to disease. So
right.
It gets really complicated when you're looking at asymptomatic people for certain things like this. Now, as time goes on and our databases get stronger and stronger and we have more information, some of this may be possible, because of course they do pre-pregnancy screening now for some common things like cystic fibrosis and that type of thing. But the genes have to be, it's usually one gene, and the diagnostic rate for mutations in that gene usually is really high. So like for CF, the testing that's available now is it picks up like 99% of the mutations. So you're not likely to miss something in a parent in regards to carrier status.
Are there any known genetic triggers specifically that you're aware of for this particular type of disease coming on for that leads to autism, or it's just a random thing that you find?
Well, it's mitochondrial disease in general. If somebody has a change in one of their genes, that's a hardwired alteration in their body. Now, that doesn't mean that outside environmental factors don't influence the expression of those genes. And that's certainly known to be the case. And so what I mean by that is people can be born and have reduced energy production, but certain stressors that impact their bodies can lead to a worsening of the disease, or kind of almost an onset of the disease. So it's not uncommon in patients with mitochondrial disease to see the onset or the worsening of clinical features surrounding intercurrent illnesses. So I had a patient who presented in her teenage years, and she had got a very bad flu, and she started to develop weakness after that. And then that weakness became progressive throughout her lifetime until the point when she was in her 30s and 40s, and early 40s, and she could no longer lift her children. She couldn't pick them up. So there are environmental issues. Now, of course, you know, there's in the ASD community, there's always the question about vaccines. Now, vaccines are a stressor to the body, that they elicit immune response. That's what they're supposed to do. But there's been a lot of discussion about mitochondrial disease and whether or not those immunizations can cause the onset of the problems. Now, again, it doesn't cause it, but precipitate some of the symptoms. And some groups have done some flawed studies, I would say, at best, but they did their best to try to get some data, and they felt that it was the fever that could be associated with immunization that was really the link to precipitating the onset of mitochondrial symptoms, and not the immunization itself. But, you know, again, there's not that many studies done in the mitochondrial community, and that was one. And like I said, it was a flawed study. I'm not going to get into the details about why it was flawed, but nonetheless, I mean, it's, you know, they did the very best they could with the data they had, but that was their conclusion following that study.
And it's interesting that, you know, basically about 50% of evaluations come out positive, where there still could be the, you know, all the other signs that you mentioned. And so if somebody has, you know, autonomic, you know, dysfunction, temperature dysregulation, fatigue, seizures, et cetera, low muscle tone, those can be pretty common. Can we, since we might go through all of that testing and find out, well, it didn't come up positive, but you have all the signs, so we really still think that it's there. I'm wondering if it's easy enough, and I always work with natural solutions. Are there natural, you know, supplementation things? I know supporting the gut, of course, and the liver, all of the detoxification issues. Could we, by working through those in someone's systems, working to heal them up, balance them, could that be the way to best work with this naturally, or what do you generally do with these people to work with them to help
well,
them?
Well, it's certainly a couple of things, and that was what I was going to segue into next in terms of the implications or the treatment and management specifically of mito and you know, the mito autism kids. So in part, it depends on their clinical symptoms, of course. You know, if somebody has a severe seizure disorder, they're going to be treated for that depending on their seizures. I mean, I've used and am using cannabis oil for CBD oil for a number of these kids, and it's showing to be helpful in a number of patients. But nonetheless, you know, the neurologist will use anticonvulsants. So again, it depends on the severity of the problem as to the amount of intervention you need to consider. Now, as far as if somebody has some low tone and maybe some mild autonomic dysfunction and you know, ASD features, is there anything that we can utilize that helps their body produce energy more effectively? Well, there are cofactors for that electron transport chain. Now, remember, as you know and your audience knows, that you know these supplements that are utilized for a reason, meaning, you know, we need certain things in our diet and in our body because they're cofactors and they help certain enzyme systems and pathways work more appropriately. So there's something referred to as the mito cocktail that consists of things like CoQ10, carnitine, riboflavin. You know, these things are cofactors for that pathway, and they help that pathway produce energy more effectively. Now, the studies are that we have available to date are certainly not conclusive, meaning that all of us in the field certainly recognize that some of our patients seem to respond quite nicely to the cocktail and others don't seem to at all. And we don't have a really good handle on why that is. I mean, I have some theories about it, but of course, you know, again, as a community, we don't know why some people respond and others don't. But the bottom line is we utilize and you typically trial the cocktail in all patients to see if it does improve them. And again, some people do.
About what levels do you use those, like CoQ10, carnitine, riboflavin? How much is in a cocktail? How much dosages of those are in there? Is it really, really high?
Well, that's they're pharmacological doses. So for example, in a 20 kilo child, so that's like about 45 pounds, that child, we would typically use, about 200 to 400 milligrams of CoQ a day. So that's a pretty big dose of CoQ. Most of the capsules, for example, are 100 milligrams a day. But and some of these things are weight dependent, and then other things there's just maximum doses we use. So like riboflavin or B1, which happens to B2, sorry, happens to be a cofactor for complex 1 in the energy pathway, the electron transport chain. We use a dose of 100 milligrams a day across the board, whether you're a baby or an adult. So it just depends on the supplement. And it also depends in part on the clinician and their experience and you know, what they use and what they think has been more effective in their patient population.
Mm-hmm. And is this an ongoing daily supplemental, or do you use this cocktail for a specific, short period of time?
If somebody truly has mitochondrial disease, it's an ongoing treatment. Now, some people, of course, will take it for some period of time and say they don't feel like it's helping them, so they'll discontinue it. But treatment is really recommended for lifetime.
Okay, interesting. All right, and I know that you have some websites and some other places that people could gather some more information on their own if they like. Would you share those with our listeners?
Sure. Well, two things. One, our website has a number of my lectures and other resources on it, and it's vmpgenetics.com. And so my husband keeps that jam-packed full of information. The other thing is we have a Facebook page with 16 or 17,000 fans, and I do during the not during the summer, because most people are out and about in the summer, but usually from the fall until May, I will do at least once a month a blog, and those blogs are about some topic in mitochondrial rare disease. And so I've got a number of blogs. For example, I did a three-part series on medical cannabis last year and then updated it recently. I think it was in April or May, and did an update on the use of medical cannabis in mitochondrial disease specifically. So that's been also been a good resource for information on various topics. So I'll talk about that. I'll talk about pain management. I will talk about any number of topics that relate to this patient population.
Okay, wonderful. Well, again, thank you so much for your time today. This has been extremely helpful for, I'm sure, a lot of people, especially seizures. A lot of people are really searching for what the issue is, or the low energy, of course, muscle tone, the fatigue, that all of those issues. So many of our kids have it. We see those problems, but a lot of people don't know to even look into mitochondrial issues and what can be done about it. So I'm sure that this will be very, very helpful for so many people today. And again, I just want to thank you so much for giving us your time, because I know you're a very, very busy person. Do you have anything else to add before we finish?
I think the only thing I'd like to add, Karen, to that, aside from the thank you for the opportunity, is for people to know that, particularly with the mitochondrial autism kids, the implementation of therapy, the addressing of their problems, the use of protocols for management of sick time and avoidance of certain medications during surgery and just for routine care has proven to be very helpful and to this patient population. And Richard Fry and Dan Rosignol did publish a report to that effect a handful of years ago. So I think while I'm not indicating or recommending that every child get worked up for mitochondrial disease, if those red flags do exist and it is a consideration, it's not just an academic pursuit. It has very real implications for a family and for an individual child. So I think if there are concerns, certainly I think it's well worth a family's efforts to investigate it.
Right. Yes, absolutely. And my book is about also, you know, healing the gut, getting the heavy metal detoxification, healing the liver, and then, you know, neural support to you know, kind of help those pathways as well. So this is right along in those in that information. I mean, so many of these kids just follow in so many similar patterns, and there are a lot of natural solutions out there. So, you know, that's why my greatest inclination is to just help educate our parents with as much positive education as they can get, so that they know when they're making decisions that they're making good, informed decisions for their children, or they know where to go to find those answers that they need. Because sometimes they just say, "What's going on?" and nobody knows. Many doctors I have found don't know. So sometimes parents have to just really do so much research on their own. So hopefully this is very helpful to a lot of people today. And again, this is Karen Thomas with NaturallyHealingAutism.com, and I'm also at Facebook, Naturally Healing Autism. And this is Dr. Fran Kendall that has joined us today on the geneticist on mitochondrial dysfunction. So again, thank you so much, Dr. Kendall, for sharing your time with us today and your information.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Karen.
All right. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.